Our study of Sefer Melachim Aleph, and we're at the beginning of Parak Gimel, Chapter 3, which definitely begins in a complex way, because what we had accomplished in Parak Beis was Shlomo really stepping into being king in the sense of tying up all the loose ends. He actually put an end to Adoniah, who, again, if you don't want to classify what Adoniah did as a rebellion, you don't have to, but it was something inappropriate towards trying to take power. And he addressed the Kohen Gadol, Evyasar, he addressed Yoav, he addressed Shimi ben Gera, and the Perek ended, Perek Beis ended with the phrase, Vahamalcha Nechona B'yad Shlomo, that the kingdom was established, it was firm, Shlomo was now on good footing. And we begin Perek Gimel by hearing what seems to be Shlomo's first marriage, and it's a union that a lot of ink is spilled on, and I think it's going to be one of those places where perhaps our questions are going to be greater than the answers that are given. Because Parak Gimel begins, Vayischatein Shlomo es Paro, Melech Mitzrayim. He made a marriage with Paro, so it can't be Paro himself, but with Paro's daughter. And that seems to be his first, right? Vayikach as bas Paro, right? Vayischatein is a language of marriage.
How old was he then? About 18?
So Shlomo's age here, the question is how far along in his kingdom. It may be 4 years into being king. Which would make him, 16. From Rashi and most people's perspective, around 16. The Barbanel felt Shlomo was older, a little bit of a das yachid, and an individual thought he thought Shlomo was older, so somewhere around 20, 24. So Vayischatein Shlomo as Paro Melech Mitzrayim, Vayikach as Bas Paro, he took the daughter of Paro, Vaviel, or David, he brought her to the city of David, to the city of his father, and she remained in that main part of the city, for a while, ad kaloso livnos es beso, until Shlomo finished building his palace, a project which hasn't started yet, v'es beis Hashem, and until Shlomo finished building the Beis HaMikdash, a second project which hasn't started yet, v'es chomo Yerushalayim saviv, and the walls of Yerushalayim all around, a third project that Shlomo hadn't started with. So she remains in the city until we're going to read about maybe she had a special place where she could live. So this is Shlomo's first marriage. And it's to a foreign woman from a foreign country. She's definitely not born Jewish. She's definitely not born Jewish. The idea of mentioning, you know, the pasuk telling us first that the Shlomo's actions had something to do with Paro, Vayischatein Shlomo es Paro, he became connected to Paro, and then it mentions and he took Paro's daughter. So the pasuk is almost pointing us in the direction Perek Gimel Pasuk Aleph. The pasuk is almost pointing us in the direction that there was a motive here, and it wasn't romance. The motive in having a marriage, right, in the language of Vayikach, definitely a very biblical language. That's how when the Torah informs us in Sefer Devarim and Parshas Ki Seitzi about marriage, it says Ki Yikach Ish Isha. The language of Kicha, of taking, is a Jewish language of marriage. And so, but it mentions before, so you know, what relationship mentions the father-in-law before the bride? Well, a relationship that's going for some type of alliance, some type of national alliance. Egypt is a neighboring country. From the time, I guess from this time, we don't hear about Mitzrayim so much during the reign of David, but from this time until the end of the Sefer, Mitzrayim plays a role in Jewish history, being one of the neighbors, and sometimes being a positive neighbor, and sometimes being not such a positive neighbor. But Shlomo wants to have a connection to Egypt, and so he marries the daughter of Paro. The Rashi, quoting from the Gemara, picks up on the point that this is right next to Shimi ben Gera having been killed, and Shimi ben Gera was a complex figure. But we had mentioned the idea that while he was in Yerushalayim, he became like a teacher of Shlomo. And Shlomo had warned him that he's not allowed to leave Yerushalayim, he's not allowed to leave a certain boundary, and if he leaves, then he's going to be killed. So Rashi quotes from the Gemara, Kol zman shehaya Shimi Rabo Kayem, as long as Shimi, his Rebbe, was around, lo nitzchatein bo, he didn't marry the daughter of Paro. Mikan amru la'olam yider adam v'makom rabo. A person, you should try to live near your teacher, because if you live near your teacher, you're going to stay on the straight and narrow. You're going to stay straight. Which implies already this statement of Chazal is pointing us in a direction that what happens here with Shlomo marrying Bas Paro is not considered to be so proper. And the biggest question that I personally have is how could, right, the statement of Chazal is saying that the effect of Shimi, that Shimi would have had on Shlomo, would have been great so much to hold him back from this marriage. But where's everybody else in his life? Where's Nasan Hanavi? Where's Batsheva, his mother? Where's Benayahu ben Yoyada? Where are the other advisors? Specifically because we know we're dealing with a young king. Where are they? And I don't have the answer. Because this approach, while you might say this actually sounds, for a young king, it sounds like a good idea. The idea is you want to try to have an alliance with a neighboring country, a peace treaty, all right? And we know, you know, some basic knowledge of history and literature in terms of, you know, the European monarchs. It was all about, you know, the kids are 4 years old and you're making a marriage between Spain and France and England. You know, I'm sure you know better than I. And so having alliances happen through marriage, it's actually a genius idea for a young kid. It's maybe even more of a unique idea in that it doesn't seem to be part of David's repertoire. David had many wives. There was one wife that was foreign. There's no indication Avshalom and Tamar had come from a convert who came from Geshur. Her father was the king of Geshur. There's not a real discussion that David was trying to make any alliances. David kind of led with might. So the fact that this is a novel idea, on the one hand, it's impressive for young Shlomo. On the other hand, it raises questions. You know, there's no precedent for this. Shlomo did not learn this from his father, though his father had many wives. And, you know, I guess we could tack on another question. You know, should this really be it sounds like this is the first marriage. Should this be the first marriage? Maybe the first marriage should be an appropriate, you know, kedas kedin beis Yaakov girl, you know, a shidduch that's going to produce the next king type of marriage. Not, and then, you know, since a king can have multiple wives, so then you should try to have an alliance here, maybe there. So a lot of these questions go. I didn't put in hours of research on this one point. It's definitely available, and I think, you know, if you find, you know, we're going to. This is the first of Shlomo's wives that come from a foreign country, and it's not the last. In the immediate future, we're not going to read about many more of them, but in the bigger picture, Shlomo will marry more foreign wives, and so there's definitely, you know, the discussion, this is not going to be the first time and only, this is not going to be the only time that we're going to discuss the topic. The whole idea of whether or not, how to look at converts during the time of David and Shlomo. So the Gemara and the Rambam codifies this. There are certain times that we accept converts and certain times that on a national level, the Jewish people don't accept converts. Now, you might think that's foreign. Your whole life that you've heard that we accept converts. Because when you're living in Gullus, and, you know, nowadays, you know, it's not always easy to be a Jew. And therefore, if someone wants to become Jewish, there's a good chance that they're doing it for the right reasons. We have a slight level of concern that someone's going to convert for the wrong reasons. But if you're in exile and things aren't, you know, not so good to be a Jew, and this person wants to, so then we accept with open arms. But during the short window in Jewish history, right, the golden age of Jewish history is the 40, you know, the 30 years of David, 33 years of David being in Yerushalayim, and then the 40 years of Shlomo. During those 73 years, things were really, really good for the Jewish people. And so on a national level, halachically, that we said no to converts. Because we assumed people, either they were converting, and Bimei David, they might have been converting out of fear. David's monarchy was so powerful. So if you were in the midst, you might convert just because you're afraid to be different. And during Shlomo's time, as we'll see, the country becomes so prosperous. You know, Lahavdil, they as far when I when my son was, I didn't know he was going to be my son when he was going to be born. We knew we were having a baby. Our first baby were in Israel, and I was having a very difficult time with the idea of renouncing citizenship. That how could I be? We weren't planning to stay in Israel long term. How could my great grandparents have died in the Holocaust, and here I am in the modern state of Israel? I'm going to renounce citizenship, and I felt so bad about it. And I remember having speaking to people about it, and basically they said I should get over my sensitivities, and it's not, you know, if we move there, that's one thing. Why should I burden my child with something, right? If it's a son, an army, and all of that? So I was willing to get over it. We had a son, so. And I was ready to renounce citizenship. And then the Misrat HaPnim, the interior ministry, they told me that you don't have to. It's not automatic. You're not an automatic citizen anymore. Because so many people, and this was in 2008, so many people from foreign countries were coming, pregnant women were coming to give birth in Israel, so that people from Thailand and the Philippines, Israel is an amazing country. Well, we know that, period. But Israel's an amazing country in comparison to other places. So people want to have children there. So they stopped that you're not an automatic citizen. Rather, you have to apply for citizenship and go through. So we weren't staying there long enough. So I didn't do that. So in the end, I didn't have to. It was all exercise and morality. But it was, so they.
This happened in 2008?
2008.
It's interesting because when I was there in 1979, it was an automatic thing.
Right. So I think it was very, in the waves.
Hard to renounce it really was.
So
I mean, for various reasons.
So when things are good for Israel, people want to come there. So during the time of Shlomo, things were so good that the Sanhedrin was nervous. People were converting just because it was good to be a Jew. So in general, this was a time period that didn't accept converts on a national level. So there was definitely some question in terms of. How accepted was this Bas Paro as a convert? In case the questions that we asked haven't been enough, the third question, or another question, is the idea that one is not allowed to marry an Egyptian convert until the third generation. The Torah tells us that for three generations, one shouldn't marry an Egyptian. It goes back to the Egyptian story and that issue that, you know, we left there. We were slaves there and we left. And it's Xeris HaKosov. So how could, here we have Bas Paro. She went from being the princess of the daughter of Paro to queen of, you know, one of the queens of Israel. That's one generation. That's not, there's no gap. So there was a Das Yachid, the same, there was an individual opinion that we don't follow the halacha the same way. You know, so part of the
more than one generation because
One generation from being Egyptian, Egyptian. If you were Egyptian, some of these. We'll get back to what you said because you got the where I was going, but just the some of these laws have kind of fallen out of place because of Sancheiriv. Sancheiriv, who was the king of Ashur, Assyria, when he dispersed the 10 tribes, he didn't just have it out for Israel. He had it out. He was, you know, like a dictator, emperor, making an empire. And his approach was always taking people from here and from here, and mixing places so that nobody in that whole region, the whole Middle East region, no one really retained their nationality. And so some of the laws that we have, there's a law you're not allowed to marry the seven natural nations in Canaan. The Canaan, the Chiti, you know, the Prizi, those seven, you're not supposed to marry them. So there it seems like it's a whole long list of people you can't marry. So the Rambam writes that's only during the time that everyone had a badge, whether it wasn't a physical badge. Everyone knew where they came from. So then you can't. But once Sancheiriv made this bilbul, he made this whole mixed up where no one. That's the 10 lost tribes. They got lost because they assimilated out and they lost their identity. Same thing happened. So we could marry. But it meant that she was fresh. She's a fresh Egyptian. She's even known as an Egyptian. So how could Shlomo marry her? So there was an opinion that's similar to the idea by the nations of Ammon and Moab. So it also says you're not allowed to marry someone from Ammon and Moab. So that was the whole hullabaloo about Rus. Rus Hamoaviah, how could she be accepted? So we understand that Elimelech, when he went to Moab, he was not necessarily doing the right thing, and he and his sons were punished. But when Rus comes back, and now she's in mainstream Israel, and now she's going to marry Boaz, how is Boaz allowed to marry her? So really Boaz, there was some type of Yibum idea, that there was some type of idea that someone should step up to the plate and marry her because of Elimelech and his sons. And so there was this Ploni Almoni, this no-named fellow, who said, I don't want to marry her because I don't think I'm allowed to. And the Sanhedrin had met, and Boaz was comfortable with the halacha that, no, it only applies to a ben, a son from Moab, and a son from Ammon. That's what the halacha, but a bas, but a daughter, it doesn't apply to. And so Boaz was comfortable to marry her. He married her, and that produced David, eventually. So there was an opinion that opinion is accepted, lahalacha, about the idea of not marrying a mitzvah for three generations. So the accepted halacha is that applies to men, ben and bas equally. There was what we call a das yachid, an individual opinion that felt the same idea, that it only applies to a man and not a woman. So therefore Shlomo's marrying her. So maybe he's relying on that. It seems that Shlomo, and maybe it's due to his age, where was the advice? We don't know. But he seemed to go out on a limb to marry this Bas Paro in order to accomplish things. And maybe he was making some type of shikul, some type of calculation that it was worth risking. Again, it's hard to say worth risking halacha to accomplish this alliance with Egypt, this national level. The Gemara makes a little bit of a strange statement in Masechta Shabbos that when Shlomo married the daughter of Paro, the Gavriel, the angel, came down into the world and he stuck a stick into the Mediterranean Sea, and that stick started, earth started gathering around the stick, and that eventually became Italy, that eventually became Rome, which is Italy, and that eventually destroys the second Beis HaMikdash. And so the spiritual effect of Shlomo marrying Bas Paro, again, I imagine the country of Italy was there. Again, the imagery of it. And so, there were spiritual ramifications. Some sources say that Shlomo was trying to accomplish something positively spiritually. But what's interesting is that we're about to read in Pasuk, which we'll get to in Pasuk Gimel, about how Shlomo loves Hashem. And right now, Shlomo is fully following Hashem. And the Radak goes through a very long explanation in Pasuk Gimel, where he explains that at this point, the effect of marrying Bas Paro as his first wife did not have a negative effect on Shlomo. We're going to read about the unfortunate negative effect that foreign wives had on Shlomo, but that's at the end of his life. He's going to be king for 40 years, and we're at the very beginning. When he married this Bas Paro, we can assume, the Radak says, we can assume that she did convert properly. He did bring her into the fold. She started lighting Shabbos candles and Afrash Eschala and Nida and every good thing that a Jewish woman keeps. And that later on, decades later, when he marries more foreign women, and those foreign women start having a bad effect on him, they lop in Bas Paro, that she also had a bad effect on him. But it's really, the Radak sees it more of a later in life issue, and that right now in his youth, marrying Bas Paro did not take him off the path of following Hashem. So that, again, I think we're going to have a few more questions and answers, and I think we will mention this topic again in an unfortunate way. Pasuk Beis. So it sounds like Shlomo made this decision to marry and to have an alliance, and he's going to keep her in the city until he does these building projects, which we haven't even heard about, but we will. Rak ha'am mizabchim babamos. We're almost told in a parenthetical sense, the people were still offering sacrifices to Hashem on bamos. Bamos were the private mizbechos that were allowed. They were allowed, but the Radak says they were not preferred. They were not preferred. And we're told, ki lo nivna bayis l'shem Hashem, there had not yet been a house built for God, arayam mahim, until these days, until Shlomo is going to take care of building it. That may be a slight dig at Shlomo in the sense that he didn't build the Beis HaMikdash as quickly as possible. He could have built it quicker. And definitely, if you take the historical perspective, that David wanted to already build the Beis HaMikdash, and David took care. We had hints in Malachim and the pasuk. The Pesukim went into great detail in Divrei Yamim how David really took the steps to like get things ready. And so you want to make the argument that Shlomo had to tie up those loose ends in terms of Yoav and but. He maybe could have built them the Beis HaMikdash quicker, and he didn't. And in Pasuk Gimel, we kind of hear a little bit of a contrast. On the one hand, it says Vayehav Shlomo as Hashem. Shlomo loved God, which is a good thing. Laleches bechukos David Aviv, to go according to the decrees of his father David. Meaning, just like David followed the Dvar Hashem, so too did Shlomo. Rak babamos hu mezabeach hu maktir. Only that Shlomo, and as the Mefarshim understand, in contrast to David, would offer sacrifices on private mezbechos. Mezabeach is an idea of animal sacrifice. Maktir is maybe incense type of sacrifice. The idea being that private mizbechos were allowed, but there was, as we're about to read in the next pasuk, there was a mizbeach hagadol. Gadol not in the sense of size, but in the sense of prominence. That the Mishkan was semi-functional all the years since Shiloh was destroyed. It didn't have the Aron together with it from the time that Shiloh was destroyed in the youth of Shmuel, the downfall of Eli and Eli's family when Shiloh was destroyed by the Plishtim. The Mishkan was functional, but without the Aron. So currently it was in a place called Givon. And there was a Mizbeach. Which Mizbeach? The Mizbeach HaNechoshes, the copper Mizbeach that Moshe built in the desert. The Bezalel and Moshe built in the desert. That was a place that communal sacrifices were brought. So the daily Karban Tamid, the Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh and Yontif Musaf, certain karbanos had to be brought on the big mizbeach at the Mishkan, but everyone was invited to make their own private sacrifices at the Mishkan. You could travel. Okay, you had to. It wasn't as easy as going to your backyard and building a private mizbeach. But David made the point to try to do that. And why? Apparently, and this is not going to be foreign for us as we keep reading Malachim, but the idea of having a private mizbeach, it lends itself to Avodah Zarah. The idea of being on your own in worship, if things get a little, I'm not trying to make a comment on like satellite minyanim. But like the idea of that, it's just a joke. But the idea, the Mefarshim write you get closer to Avodah Zarah if you're on a private mizbeach. And so by coming to the Mizbeach HaGadol, by coming to the Mishkan, that it centralized things. And it was more of, so that's something that David made a point to do, even his private karbanos. And again, we didn't necessarily read about that in Sefer Shmuel, but now we're telling it. And Shlomo didn't. Shlomo, for the most part, he went ahead and he stayed local, and he brought his karbanos on private Mizbechos. However, Perhaps on the occasion of getting, according to different mafarshim, the pesukim might go out of order. So it could have been on the occasion of getting married, or on the occasion of solidifying his kingdom, as we read about at the previous end of the previous parak. Now we hear in pasuk dalid that vayelach hamelach givona lizboach sham. Shlomo went to Givon to sacrifice there. Ki hi habama hagdola. That was the bama, the high place, which is an altar, mizbeach, hagadola, that's great. In the Mesudas, David already says, gadola b'kdushasa. It was great in its sanctity. Kihi mizbeach, hanechosha, shasa moshe. And when in Divrei Yamim, when this story is told over in Divrei Yamim Beis, Perek Aleph of Divrei Yamim Beis, there's not so much new information. Usually when there's like a lot of new information, I like us to have both in front of us, throughout Sefer Malachim Aleph, more so in Beis. But there it actually says it's the Mizbeach that was built by Bezalel in the Midbar. It's like very clear that that's the Mizbeach that was in Givon. And he offers there, he brings a lot of sacrifices. So he goes there, you have to imagine, he comes with an entourage. Elef Olos Yale Shlomo. He brings 1,000 carbon ola. An ola is completely consumed on the Mizbeach. Ala Mizbeach, ahu, on that Mizbeach. Rashi says it was biyom echad. It was all in one day, which is sounds on the one hand that sounds that sounds impressive. In the back of your mind, if you think about the busiest, what was the busiest day of the year in the Beis Hamikdash? Busiest day of the year for all Kohanim and for all Jews. Busiest day. Yom Kippur is the most important day, but in terms of quantity. And maybe in quality, it's the busiest. But in terms of quantity, in terms of number of sacrifices.
Erev Pesach.
Because there's a crunch. Everyone's got to bring Karban Pesach. You got a time issue. There's only a certain, right? And they also had to, there was another Karban Chagiga that had to be brought, a special, there are three regalim. On Sukkot and Shavuos, there are three karbanos that one has to bring. One of them is called a chagiga. On Pesach, there was a bonus one called chagigas arbaasar. That's why on your Seder plate, you have the egg. Why do you have the egg? We have the egg, and we have the idea, the same way that we have the shank bone, and we roast the shank bone, so right, you roast the egg. Roasting an egg, you never roast a raw egg. What happens when you roast a raw egg? It explodes. So you have to remember when you're young and you're making Pesach for the first time, you don't always write down all the notes. You have to roast a hard-boiled egg. If you roast a hard-boiled egg, then the shell gets a little brown. It looks nice on the Seder plate. Fine. Why do we have two? So the Zroa is to remember the Karban Pesach. Now, you're never right when we say in the Haggadah, Matzazu, so you're supposed to pick up the matzah and say Matzazu, or point to it, pick it up. Mar, you're supposed to pick it up. And then in your Haggadah, it should hopefully say, don't touch the shank bone, don't point to the shank bone when you say Pesach, because it's not a Karban Pesach. You bought it in seasons. And you don't want it to have sanctity of Karban Pesach, because you're not allowed to sanctify an animal outside of Israel, outside of Yerushalayim, outside of the Harabayas. So you don't, and if you do that, it's not good. So you don't want to do that. So the Zeruah is to remember the Karban Pesach, but the egg is to remember the special Karban Chagiga that was offered specifically on the 14th. So that day was the busiest day in the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara and Psachim gets a little graphic telling us how much the Kohanim's feet were, how much blood there was. So if you're not a Kohen, then, whatever. But if you are, you have to, you got to be careful. You got to be ready, hopefully. It happens to be the Mishnayos in, I think it's in Chagiga, actually mentioned that Karban Pesach was one of the karbonos, even though it's viewed as a individual family's karbon. It had to be brought in Givon. It had to be brought at the Mizbeach HaGadol. So while I was trying to mention this whole idea, because Rashi says these were all brought in one day, and it sounds like a lot, but really, in a functional Mishkan with Kohanim there staffed, 1,000 karbanos is nothing. The Radak understands that Shlomo perhaps spent a few days with his entourage in Givon, and these karbanos were offered. They were offered all that time. He's king, so I imagine you build another one. Build 10, build 20. But maybe it seems
doing something special because right, he's married.
Either it's because he got married. It may just be again. Rashi's of the approach that the psukim go a little out of order. It may just be that now his king, now that he feels solid in his kingdom, he goes to Givon to offer this offering to Hashem. The idea of having 1,000 karbanos. So Hashem doesn't need our quantity. Hashem needs our quality. The famous Mishnah, I think it's at the end of Menachos, talks about, because the whole idea of a Karban Mincha, part of it was there so that those who couldn't afford to bring a animal sacrifice, could bring a flower sacrifice as much, right? You could have, if you could afford an some carbonos, you have options. If you can afford an animal, you should bring an animal. If you can afford a bird, you bring a bird. If you can only afford flowers, so you also have a place, right? And the Mishnah famously says, Echad hamarba ve'echad hamamit, the one who has a lot to give to God, the one who has a little bit, it doesn't make a difference. Ulvad shekivin libo b'shamayim, if they have the right intent. So you could have, you know, someone who brings 1,000 carbonos, but thinks they're all that, and they, you know, who needs God? I'm just doing this to look good. And you could have the person who brings a little skinny animal, but, you know, they saved up the whole year and they just want to serve God with purity. And that, obviously, that's much better. So when it says Elif Olos, you know, why is it a 1,000? It just could, you know, perhaps when you're king, you have to, if he just brings one carbon, it doesn't show, he has to, for his sake, not for God's sake, for his sake, he shows how much honor that he's giving to Hashem. And the carbon ola means the entire carbon is consumed on the Mizbeach. So here, on this occasion, and maybe it's due to Shlomo's decision to come to Givon, which is considered to be more proper, to offer all of these sacrifices, Hashem appears to him in a dream. The Pasuk Hey. Begivon, in Givon, in the presence of the Mishkan, Nira Hashem el Shlomo bechalom halayla. Hashem appeared to Shlomo in a dream at night. Vayomer Elokim, and Hashem said, Sha'al ma etain lach. Ask what I will give to you. Make your wish. What do you want? Right? This is obviously quite famous.
In the English it says, I should give you.
Request what I should give you. Meaning Hashem is saying, I'm ready to give you. You ask me, and you're going to get it. You know, lahavdil, it sounds like a genie in a lamp. Right? But the number one rule, right? The number one rule was, you can't ask for more wishes. Because if you're really smart, you just say, I want more wishes. But that was at least in lahavdil, in Disney's Aladdin, I think that was one of the rules. I think when we were growing up, we said you weren't allowed to wish for Mashiach to come, because if you wish for Mashiach to come, so then everything else is that's obviously what you would wish for. Okay, fine. So Hashem says, "Ask me what I should give you." And here you have quite the heroic and insightful young man. Specifically, the approach of Rashi, which was really the consensus that he was 12 and he became king. So maybe this is 4 years later. So he's all of 16 years old. Vayomer Shlomo, and Shlomo says to Hashem in a dream, which also until this point we have not seen Hashem communicate to Shlomo. So this is his first experience with what we would call prophecy, with having all prophets besides Moshe converse with Hashem only through chalom, only through dream. Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy, why we call him the Avi Avos HaNeviim, he communicated with Hashem in a totally different way. He was in a state of being awake. One of the ways the Chazal describe it is, you know, these windows are still pretty good with the dots on it, but if you have like a stained glass window with cloudy, with like a little, if you look at the street, it's a little distorted. So that other prophets were described as seeing Hashem baspaklaria she'ena mi'ira, through a window or a mirror that is not clear. While Moshe Rabbeinu, he was able to view Hashem and what Hashem wanted to show him through aspaklaria ha'mi'ira, through a window that was clear. So this is Shlomo's first experience with prophecy.
When Hashem usually appears, isn't it more in terms of like Hashem's purpose or answering the Navi or someone, as opposed to...
So this is being initiated by God.
Right, with no technical purpose in mind, you know, like...
Well, the purpose is to bestow a blessing upon Shlomo.
Right, but I'm saying, but the other times it's you know, Moshe, you know, to become the leader. You know, there's more of a thing that he wants him to do, as opposed to what do you want kind of thing.
It's unique. And maybe, you know, this, you know, here you have Shlomo, who, you know, you have to imagine he was taking notes for the first 12 years of his life, but how much could be accomplished? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is Hashem's, you know, helping hand to, you know, without David, where is Shlomo's direction? You know, I don't know if you want to understand literally, you know, maybe because this is coming after, if you don't take Rashi's approach, you take more, Barbanel, the more literal approach, that this is after his marriage to Bas Paro. I don't know, maybe from Hashem's perspective, it wasn't so proper that Shlomo made that decision. And, you know, maybe Hashem is going to give the blank check to Shlomo, we all know what Shlomo asks for, or if you don't, you'll see it soon. And maybe Hashem was hoping that he would ask for that in order to get him back more on a focused path after having made perhaps the error in marrying Bas Paro. So by Pasuk Vav again, by Yomer Shlomo says back to Hashem, Ata asisa im avdecha David avi chesed gadol. You, Hashem, you performed with your servant David, my father, a great chesed. Kasher halach lefanecha, when he walked before you, be'emes uvitztaka uviyishras levav imcha, when he walked with truth, with justice or charity, probably justice, uviyishras levav, with an upright, a straight heart, imach with you, vatishmar lo es hachesed hagadol hazeh, and you preserved, you guarded for him this great kindness, vatitan lo bein hayoshev alkiso kayom hazeh, and you provide and giving him a son to sit on his throne like this day. So the Mefarshim point out that there's multiple levels of kindness, right? It's mentioned kindness twice, and then it mentions the fact that he sits on the throne, that there were levels of David in his lifetime before becoming king. He received much kindness from Hashem in terms of his running from Shaul. David as king received kindness from Hashem in terms of surviving all of the ups and the downs, and the cherry on top, Vatitan Lobain Hayoshev Alkiso Yomazeh, that's the greatest thing that David wanted to have, at least one of his sons, and the son that he selected, that Hashem selected, to sit on his throne. Pasuk Zayin. Va'ata Hashem Elokai, and now Hashem, my God. Meaning you're not just the God of my father, you're my God. Ata himlachta es avdecha tachas David Avi. You have crowned me, your servant, in place of David my father. Vanochi nar katon, and I'm a small lad. Right? Nar is usually young. Katon is modifying. Sorry, he's young. He's very young. Lo edat seis vavo. I don't know how to come. I don't know how to go. And an expression that perhaps is used even till today. Didn't know his coming from his going. I'm inexperienced. And the idea that I was tachas David Avi. David Melch Yisrael Chai V'Chayim. Right, this is one of the hardest, shoes to step into is Shlomo stepping into the shoes of David. Pasuches, the avdecha b'soch amcha asher b'charta, and your servant, meaning me, b'toch amcha asher b'charta. I'm now in the midst of your people, meaning the Jewish people, asher b'charta that you chose. Am Rav. It's a very large nation. Asher lo yimanev, lo yisafer meirov. They can't be counted due to how large they are, right? Which is an expression that we've seen before in Tanakh. I'm just talking about how obviously Klal Yisrael can be counted. Again, how they are counted, it's not a you're not supposed to count directly, and all the things that we're aware of. But it's an expression that it's many. There were many Jews. Vinas pasuk tes vinasata la'avdecha, what you should give to your servant, meaning to me, lev shomea l'shpot es amcha, a listening heart to judge your people, lahavin bein tov l'ra, to know the difference, to understand between good and between bad, ki mi yuchal l'shpot es amcha hakaved hazeh, who is able to judge this heavy nation. The Radak says that there are two meanings to who could judge this heavy nation. The number one is there may have just been many cases. And many cases might have come before the king for judgment. As some of us saw in Sefer Shmuel, there were certain cases that would bypass the court system and go directly to the king for judgment. And if you, right, you could go to an inexperienced judge, they're going to have to, and they want to make a decision, they're going to have to deliberate on the case, they're going to have to look things up, there's no way to deal with the volume. But if he would have the ability to be that expert judge automatically, he'd be able to be much more efficient. Or the idea being is that there's a heavy weight to judging the Jewish people. If a judge in a financial matter between two Jews, if he makes an error and he causes one to pay the other when it shouldn't have been, it's going to come off his account somewhere. Not in actuality, but Hashem's going to take it out on the judge. Right? Hashem has ways to work things out that you'll be held accountable financially. Right? The Gemara uses the term Pater midine adam v'chayev bidine shemayim. You're not going to be able to be dealt with in a court. Meaning, you're probably the judge who made a mistake is not going to be, you know, I don't. The appeal system, we don't have that necessarily. But the idea being Hashem will take it out on a judge. So Shlomo is nervous to judge, to be a judge for the people in terms of his intelligence, and he's recognizing that that's a major job of being a king. On the one hand, he didn't say, I'm not going to be able to lead them out to battle. Because maybe he can appoint someone, right? He can appoint Benayahu Benayada like he did on the army. He could have advisors. In terms of judging the people, that's something that comes straight to the king, and he feels inadequate, perhaps, as he says, due to his age. And he asks for a lev shomea, a listening heart, and he asks for the ability, lahavin, to distinguish between good and bad. Because sheer knowledge alone is not enough. You have to have the ability to understand. And also there's the lev shomea may be representative of some type of intuition, or what we would maybe call street smarts. Sometimes you can't just specifically if you're going to be dealing with people and emotions, you have to have your wits about you, not just in terms of knowledge, but in terms of ability to read someone, in terms of the ability to interact. And so this is what he asks for. Pasuk Yud. Vayitav hadavar b'enei Hashem, like a lahavdil, like a parent. Nothing can be greater. You ask your kid whatever you want, and he tells, right? And imagine it's 20 years ago, and you offer your child anything they want, and they say we want a copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica, right? That's the gift that we want. So, you know, now if they said we just want access to Wikipedia, you'd have to be, you know, they probably want other things also. But the idea, you give anything you want, a parent has so much nachas from such a request. Right? He could have asked for a car or a bike, who knows what. Vayitav hadavar b'nei Hashem. The matter was very good. Sorry. Vayitav hadavar b'nei Hashem. It was good in the eyes of Hashem. Kishal Shlomo hadavar says that Shlomo requested this matter. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayomer Elokim Eilav, Hashem says to him, Yan asher sha'alto es hadavar hazeh. Because you asked, or due to the fact that you asked for this thing, V'lo sha'alta l'cha yamim rabim, you didn't ask for old age, long days of being king. You want your monarchy, you yourself to last for a long time, or your children to stay in your place for a long time. V'lo sha'alta l'cha osher, you didn't not ask for wealth. V'lo sha'alta nefesh oivecha, you didn't ask for the lives of your enemies, meaning you didn't ask that you should be successful and have easy battles in your surroundings. V'sha'alta l'cha havin l'shma mishpat. And what did you? You asked for yourself to understand l'shma mishpat, in order to listen and to understand judgment. So says Hashem, Pasuk Yud Beis, Hinei asisi kidvarecha. Behold, I am going to do according to your words. Hine nasati l'cha, behold, I have given to you, which means it's kind of like happening in this dream while he's sleeping. Hashem gives him this gift. of Lev Chacham v'Navon, a Lev Chacham, that he's going to have a heart that's full of Chacham, meaning wisdom, v'Navon, and understanding, the ability to understand. Asher kamocha lo haya lefanecha, v'acharecha lo yakum kamocha. Who before you, kamocha lo haya lefanecha, before you, there was no one like this. V'acharecha lo yakum kamocha, and after you, there's going to be no one like you. That the what you are going to possess is considered to be unique. What's interesting is that the same way that Shlomo asked for a lev shomea lishmotas amcha, Hashem gives him exactly what he asked for, because it didn't just say chacham v'navon. It talks about the lev. It talks about the heart, which I guess, you know, maybe in an hour 2019 type of thinking, this goes beyond, it's like, I don't know, you call it emotional intelligence, emotional wisdom, an ability that goes beyond just, he got the knowledge, he got sheer knowledge, but he possessed something more, and perhaps as a shofet, as a judge, that was really what was necessary. A, that's what he requested, and B, that's what he needed. When it says Asher kamocha lo haya fanecha v'acharecha lo yakum kamocha, so the Radak says Afilu Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Asher kamocha lo haya lefanecha, that there was no one like before you. So the Radak says even Moshe Rabbeinu, in terms of what's called bechachmas, what the Radak calls, and I can't say I fully understand this, bechachmas hateva lo haya kamo, within a wisdom of nature. Wisdom of this world, of concrete matters in this world, but the Radak writes Avol bechachmas ha'elokus, hu chacham yoter imenu. In terms of chachmas elokus, in terms of divine wisdom, Torah knowledge, ability to understand Torah, maybe that Moshe was greater. That Moshe was greater. So, the or what the Radak says, O Perush, the Radak's second approach is when it says Asher kamocha lo haya lefanecha v'acharecha lo yakum kamocha, it means in his position as king. I mean, he's going to be the king who, let's say, if we're calling him the smartest or the wisest, right? Even sometimes that's actually how he gets described, right? King Solomon, the wisest of all kings. I don't know if that statement is picking up on the Radak explanation. It just could be because he was a wise king. But the Radak says, you know, I think what the Radak is basically bothered by is if you go backwards. So we all know that Moshe Rabbeinu was considered to be the greatest. But Moshe Rabbeinu could be the greatest leader. Shlomo could be the greatest king. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have the status of being a king. He was from the tribe of. From the tribe of Levi. So in prophecy, definitely. And that's actually one of the... every morning, some people, depends on how much time you have, in the back of the Siddur, you'll see that there are six things that you're supposed to remember every single day. That the Torah tells you, the Torah goes out of its way to tell you. You should remember the Mun. You should remember Amalek. You should remember the experience at Har Sinai. You should remember what happened to Miriam when they were traveling. So what happened, right? We know Miriam spoke Lashon Hara, and that, well, so Lashon Hara is nice, and not, Lashon Hara is not nice. Lashon Hara, the idea about Lashon Hara and not speaking Lashon Hara, it's important, right? The Chavetz Chaim made it very famous. We should all keep it. The Chavetz Chaim goes, in the beginning, he writes that they're like countless sins, that one, if you speak one sentence of Lashon Hara, and, you know, My kids sometimes, they do the opposite. They'll be like, oh, but it's not true. Well, okay, if it's not true, then it's Motzi Shemra. That's also bad. If it's true, then it's Lashon Hara. So either way, this is not a good thing to be said. So, but should that really be one of the things that we remember every single day? So my Rabbi Shachter likes to explain, you have to go to what was the root of Miriam speaking Lashon Hara? When Miriam spoke Lashon Hara, it was that she said, Aaron and I are prophets, and Moshe is a prophet. Why did he have to separate from his wife? Well, I'm not separated from my husband. Aaron's not separated from his wife. Who's Moshe? Well, who does he think he is? So what happened was is that Hashem responded. He immediately called them to the Ohel Moed. And I think either Miriam or Aaron, one of them, both of them had been recently intimate with their spouse, and so they weren't in a state of purity, so they had to purify themselves before coming to Ohel Moed. And his message was is that the level of prophecy that I have with Moshe is totally different. Moshe has to be ready to be here at any beck and call. He's got to be ready to come. So the idea, when we have the idea to remember the Lashon Hara, it's to remember that Moshe's prophecy was unique, and that's why it's one of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith. One of the 13 things that a Jew is supposed to believe. Usually, you know, I sometimes deal with teenagers who have issues of faith. Usually it's not this one that they're bothered by, that we're supposed to believe in the prophecy of Moshe more so than any other prophet. It might be the one that comes before. I mean, there is a separate belief to believe in prophecy. But secondly, you need to believe that the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu was on a different dimension, a different level. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu is the only prophet who can command something that's still binding. All other prophets can command something for a generation, for a time, what we call a Hora Asha. They prophesize with the phrase, as you'll be familiar from the Navi, Ko Amar Hashem, so said Hashem, which is temporary. Now, the messages of the Navi can be applicable in every generation. That's actually the point. It's only messages that could still resonate in 5779 are recorded. The messages that were just for that time stay in that time. If it gets recorded, it means it has value for all generations. But Moshe Rabbeinu, he prophesizes what we call Zeh HaDavar. He prophesizes in a way that a mitzvah that we keep, and all the mitzvahs, there's not one mitzvah of the 613 that we keep because someone else commanded it. The only reason why we give a bris milah to our children, our sons, is not because Avraham Avinu had a bris milah. It's only because Moshe Rabbeinu also commanded it. The only reason why we don't eat Gid Hanasha is not only because that Yaakov and his sons were told, because Moshe Rabbeinu also commanded it. So Rav Schachter explains that's the idea of staying away, of remembering what Miriam did, is to tap into the Rambam's principle of faith of remembering that Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy is different. So here, what the Radak was saying, he's kind of bothered by, everyone's going to say, how could Shlomo be better than Moshe? So the different arenas. This is what the Radak calls Chachmas Hateva, and then what he calls Chachmas Elukus. Maybe you want to explain it that in prophecy, Shlomo wasn't anywhere near the prophet that Moshe was. But in terms of wisdom, of sheer wisdom of this world, that Shlomo, he attained greatness. And then Hashem goes on to say, Pasuk Yud Gimel, V'gam asher lo sha'alta nasati lach. Also that which you did not ask me, I'm going to give to you. Gam osher, wealth, Gam kavod, and honor, asher lohaya kamocha ish bimalachim kol yamecha, who has like the amount of wealth and kavod that like you no other man amongst kings will have. We're going to see the city of Yerushalayim and the monarchy of Shlomo. It becomes an international destination. Not just the Beis Hamikdash is going to play a role in that, but the prominence that Shlomo has, the wealth and the honor that he attains for himself, as we see, it's being a gift coming from God. It really was quite unique, and it made an impact on the neighboring countries. Pasuk Yudalet, Hashem closes this chalom, this dream, and the gift by saying, "V'im telech b'derachai, if you go on my way, lishmar chukai mitzvasai, to guard my decrees and my mitzvos, kasher halach David avicha, just like your father did, v'harachti es yamecha, I will lengthen your days." And there's really a double meaning in "I will lengthen your days," as I'll lengthen your days, you, meaning your life, and I'll lengthen your days in terms of the ability for your children to continue after you, for the dynasty to go on forward. Some of the Mefarshim pick up on the idea that it was specifically the Arichas Yamim that was conditional on following in the ways of Hashem. That having long life, both for Shlomo and for his dynasty after him, that was dependent on following the Dvar Hashem. But the other gifts, whether it be the wisdom, whether it be the wealth, whether it be honor, that was almost unconditional. And I think the Mefarshim say that because when you look at the end of the story, Shlomo did not have a long life, and Shlomo did not have dynastic continuation. His dynasty did not continue to the same level that he had. However, for all the life that he had, he always had his wisdom, he always had his wealth, and he always had his honor. So there were certain gifts that were given by Hashem in without conditions, and the last line of saying Arichas Yamim was given in condition, and that Shlomo, this was not his intention. Shlomo's intention was to only get wisdom, but because he was, and again, even if we open the perek by not necessarily being impressed with his decision to marry Bas Paro, we're definitely in the middle of the perek, quite impressed that this young, without, and again, this isn't a dream. He doesn't have a chance to ask an advisor. He doesn't have a chance to run to Batsheva or to Nasan or to Benayahu and say, oh, Hashem is giving me a one wish. What do I ask for? And you know, you take, he does it himself. He's willing to ask for the wisdom himself. And so Hashem extends, definitely gave Shlomo the tools to succeed by giving him much blessing. We'd run one more pasuk. Pasuk Tesvav. Vayikatz Shlomo v'hine chalom. Shlomo, and he woke up, and behold, it was a dream. So Rashi says, quoting from the Medrash, that he knew v'hine chalom means he knew the dream had come true. Because he woke up, and he heard the animals. He heard the bird, Rashi says, he heard Of Mitzavtseif, Umaven Lashono. He heard the birds chirping, and he understood what one bird was saying to the next. Kelev Noveach, Umaven Lashono, and he heard a dog barking, and he understood what a dog, right, say, right? Can you imagine understanding what
it's like, gee, that would be really good.
Right? So what exactly that means, I have a certain love for animals. Other people have other animals. They have intelligence. They don't. We don't have the same amount of intelligence as people. We're okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what does it mean? But they have some. Meaning, there's some type of communication on some level. And so Shlomo understood that. And so once he understood that, he realized I'm a lot smarter than I was yesterday, and that the dream came into effect. And it's specifically what the Radak had said. His chachmas hateva, his knowledge of nature of this world, was increased, and his reaction is interesting. Vayavo Yerushalayim, he comes home. Vayamod lifnei Aron bris Hashem, and he stands before the Aron. Of the covenant of God, which was located in Yerushalayim. His father, David, had brought it to Yerushalayim. It was in a special tent in Yerushalayim. Mm-hmm. And while he receives this dream in Givon, he feels to acknowledge Hashem and Hashem's presence, he goes to the Aron. And there, Vayal Olos, Vayash Shlamim, he brings more karbanos, Olos, that are completely burnt, but also Shlamim, everyone can partake in. Vayas mishteh l'chol avadav, he made a great party, or he made a party for all of his servants as an act of celebrating this wisdom that he has, which again, he only requested in order that he'll be a successful king. And so as he's now attained this high level of wisdom as a gift. Most people to attain anywhere close to that have to work on it. He got it as a gift. But that when you attain a Torah knowledge, there's an idea of making a party, and the Beis Yosef on the tour says that's one of the reasons why we celebrate on Simchas Torah and Asiyum to celebrate completion. So normally it comes through hard work, right? Sitting through Torah laning for the whole year, if you can hear it, it's an accomplishment. If you learn through a whole Masechta, a whole Seder, that's an accomplishment. So the celebration that's learned from here, where Shlomo celebrated attaining the knowledge, he got it all as a gift. And Bez Hashem, next time we'll pick up with the first time that Shlomo got to show the world just how smart he had become.